Let's take a second to read this. This is actually from something that y'all will be reading this semester. It's a translation of the Tao Te Ching that a friend of mine and I did. So it's Chinese, but this is the very first poem. It's very famous. This book has been translated, is the second most translated book in the world after the Bible. All right. Y'all take a second to read it to yourselves. This is Tao Te Ching, Poem 1, by the Chinese. It's purported to be by someone named Lao Tzu, but he probably never existed. Anyway, Wei, Tao, expressible in words is not eternal way. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. The nameable is the mother of 10,000 things. Therefore, always be without desire to observe this mystery. Being with desire always observes the boundary. These two things come from the same, but with different names. Both are called profound. Profound and again profound, the door of many mysteries. The Tao Te Ching, the Analects of Confucius, the doctrines of Zoroaster, the Vedas of India, the Rig Veda, the prophets of Israel, the Greek tragedians, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Homer, a couple hundred years before them, Hesiod, Socrates, Buddha, Confucius, lived during a period of history that my mentor's mentor, Carl Jaspers. Carl Jaspers, spelled Jaspers, but it's German, it's pronounced Jaspers. Carl Jaspers called the Axial Age. And by this term, what Jaspers meant to say is that from basically, the best way to think about it is that from 800 BCE, before the Common Era, to about 600 CE, the Common Era, every question and every way of valuing life and pondering existence was asked. And there's an especially rich period of time in which Buddha, Socrates, Confucius, and a few other important figures all lived within 100 years of each other. So this axial age or axial period or axial epoch is the epoch that has given us the majority of the questions that we ask today. And what we've mostly done is refined methods and techniques of how we ask the questions. So in that regard, you would say that the organized religions that we have and the different movements we've had in art and the different kinds of scientific investigations we've developed are new ways of asking and following through on these questions that were asked, that began to be asked about 2,800 years ago. This is one of the most simple expressions of the conundrum that we find ourselves in. Way expressible in words is not eternal way. What do you think that means?
It means that you can't put it, you can't name something that you can't really explain because it's so, I guess, over-encompassing. Like, it's like, you can't just say the word religion and then talk about or define religion by saying religion, because religion comes to so many other things and everything like that. So you can't just bring things into one meaning or one word.
Okay.
There's two different ways. Because he talks about later, nameable and nameless.
Uh-huh.
So, and then he says there, the name that cannot be named or can be named is not the name, is not the eternal name. So the eternal name is the nameless, and the name that can be named is the mother.
Right. And when you see the word 10,000, when you see the notion 10,000 things.
Existence or reality. Right?
That's everything. Right? 10,000 was a big number to people in 800 BCE or 600 BCE. There's 10,000. Oh, there's 10,000 troops outside. Oh my God, it's the end of the world. Right? And then the Mongols. And they show. I'll show you what a lot of people are. Okay. So basically, whenever you see that word, the 10,000 things, that means everything. Let's not get into too much into the Chinese, because then that becomes a different course. But I want you to know that word Tao, just because it's a word that's come into English enough that you should know the term. So there we are. I mean, you know, you've got the way that can be named is not the eternal way, meaning the process that you can actually name is not the process that's making everything do what it does. Right? And this is the thing that we struggle with whenever we talk about anything. Right? And we can just take this just to pure simple physics. What does the word Adam actually mean in Greek? Adam, A-T-O-N. What does the word Adam actually mean in Greek? Do you know? It means indivisible. Now then, what are the parts of an atom? Protons, neutrons, electrons. Okay. What are the parts of those things? Quarks. And what is the diverse 11 dimensions that might allow for the quarks to interact with these strings? And. Okay. You name it, and we always end up saying, that's it. And then, oh wait, somebody says, that's not it. And then they answer, but this is it. Oh no. And this is it. Well, now we've gotten to the issue with string theory that there's actually there's no way to test that theory that we can come up with. So that one might get to stick for a while because it's untestable. So when you get into this, you're talking about metaphysics, which is supposedly the bailiwick of religion. So, or one of the bailiwicks of religion. But the point here mostly is now to come down here. The nameless is the origin of heaven and earth. So heaven and earth would be all reality. Okay. The nameable is the mother of all the things we see. So So when you say it's the mother of all the things that we see, what that means is, as soon as you differentiate one thing, everything else comes. As soon as you differentiate one thing, it just turns into a game of differentiation. Oh, but here's something else. There's this and there's not this. Not this is this and it's not this. That not this is this and it's not this. That not this is this and it's not this. Differentiate, differentiate, differentiate. Boom, 10,000 things, 10 million things, 10 billion things, 10 trillion things, 10 infinities of stuff. This one little poem actually captures the conundrum that thinkering humanity always falls into. As soon as we start to think we're really difficult, really hard, and we put our thinking caps on, and we start really getting in there, we never stop theorizing. Because we never stop finding more. Yet at the same time, there's the notion, and there are different notions of this, because you can differentiate it. At the same time, there's the notion that things start. Right? Did you know that there are Indian and Chinese physicists who say that there's a problem with the whole theory of the Big Bang because it takes for granted an Abrahamic, Jewish, Christian, Islamic way of looking at it? That there has to be a start. Here, there's not actually a start, except that we name a start. Stuff's just doing what stuff does. It's just doubting. Yeah?
But in that same respect, there's not really a start in religion either, because who created the gods that manifest in these different religions?
Well, this is the issue that actually now, you know, exactly what we come to in thinking about this is that every start we put forward, whether it's an art or religion or science, every start we put forward is always a start we choose. Right? And so we end up in this situation where sometimes what we have to spend centuries doing is refining how we figured out that was the start and then throwing it over the side or reconfabulating it. Yeah, Connor?
We were talking about how when you're growing up, you were influenced by your parents and you're thinking like a little whimsy or whatever happened, you just use a whole people's thing that you're happy.
Well, actually, my mentor was raised an agnostic, and his parents were... He was born in Kentucky to a man that managed a whiskey company and horse farms, and neither his mother or his father was religious in any way, shape, or form. So he was raised an agnostic. But that's a tradition, right?
The whole thing, the starting thing. I can't remember if it was Aristotle or if it was Socrates. He talks about when he's talking about his law or his ideas of motion, with the first mover, like the original mover that moves,
right,
and then the universe moves around, or is pushed from that, is what causes the universe and like all of reality to move.
Well, that's a good place to. That's a good thing to. That's a good thing to think about for a second, because actually, what Aristotle does there is he says, if you read it very carefully, what Aristotle says is either the universe always has been, which is the end of the discussion. If it always has been, there's actually no way to accomplish an adequate way of investigating it.
We would never know, or like, I mean, it might not be in our existence.
exactly, you can't pop, but he says, we're here to do an investigation. So for the purposes of the investigation, let us say that the world starts here with the first motion of an entity that itself cannot be moved. So the idea here is either the universe is always in motion, and that's the end of the discussion. Now, take that into your mind and begin to contemplate your navel. Or, the universe started, and we can figure some stuff out about that. But see, now you get into how, you know, especially through Islamic scholars who influenced Jewish and Christian scholars in the Middle Ages, to take in the Aristotelian viewpoint and the Platonic viewpoint, and refine that viewpoint. The critique of these Indian and Chinese scientists is, you are Abrahamic Aristotelians. You think that you posit that everything has to have started at some point. Our cultural tradition says everything has always been going on, and we are now beginning to develop hypotheses that don't necessarily see the investigation in Aristotle is to figure out where the starting place is at. They're saying, no, we can use physics to think about the world, but we're not going to bother ourselves with getting bogged down in origins. So what happens when you think about the world as an ever-ongoing process versus a process that starts and then stops? That has a Bible exam at the end of it. Right? But again, this beautiful little poem says all of these things in one sense, right? So therefore, always be without desire to observe this mystery. Being with desire always observes the boundary. What does that mean? What does that mean? No. What's your name?
Hoa.
Hoa? Hoa. Can you spell it for me?
H-A-W-A.
Okay, Hoa.
Can you briefly?
Yeah, what does it mean when he says, therefore always be without desire to observe this mystery? Being with desire always observes the boundary. What do you think that means? Let's think about the first time you ever fell in love. You remember that first time you ever fell in love?
Yeah.
That first person who you looked at one day, they were just irritating you. And the next day, you're like, oh my God, I spent the rest of my life. You remember that? Kind of, sort of. Or maybe you didn't think, maybe you were just like, you know, I don't know. Who was the first person you ever fell in love with? If you don't mind being so interested.
Gerald? Yeah.
Okay. And so the day before you were like, oh my God, Gerald. Oh. And the next day you're like, oh my God, Gerald. What? But now, see, here's the deal. The desire just changed Gerald. Right? Gerald was Geraldine.
Geraldine.
He was getting in the way of you hauling, but he was Geraldine. And he was like, da-da-da-da-da. Suddenly, Gerald! And now he's got a boundary. Now he's Gerald. With hearts coming out of your eyes. Right? Until he pissed you off. And then he was Gerald. And now he's a different kind of desire, right? Because you desire to not like him anymore. Desire puts the boundary around things. It's the limit. It's what actually allows you to differentiate. In other words, Geraldine, he's not really so much suddenly on your radar. Then suddenly, Gerald. Now it's bound. Right. This is something that happens in religious experience too. Right? these two things, the nameless and the nameable, come from the same, but they're different names. So he's actually already recognizing, yeah, there's a, I mean, here's the deal. He starts off the Tao Te Ching saying, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. Now let me talk about it for 81 poems. He says, the nameless is really awesome, and when desire kind of like gets doing what it does, it makes the boundary, and that boundary, you know, that's when you differentiate this from that, and now, boom, there's all this other stuff. It's all nameable stuff, right? But then he kind of comes back and he says, the two, the nameless and the nameable, come from the same but with different names. So that he's recognizing what I'm talking about is the very thing I'm critiquing. What I'm doing is the very thing I'm critiquing. Don't ever forget that. That's what makes this philosophy. Philosophers like Aristotle is admitting, almost everybody in the Greek world believed that the universe, actually the cosmos, the order of things, had always been. Right? And so he wasn't saying, I'm telling you now, that's kind of like the way tradition has always been, we just don't question it. But I kind of want to question it. In order to question it, I'm going to do these things here, where I'm going to start naming stuff and defining things and putting boundaries around stuff. But at the same time, he was telling you, I recognize that the majority of people think this, but this is how I want to think about it for the moment. And then people come along and they say, I like that thinkering better than the old thinkering, and that becomes a tradition. There's always this tradition, this giving ourselves over to tradition. Giving ourselves over to things that we will end up taking for granted. All right, let's see what happens. I want to get one more take it for grantedness from you guys. What's fixing to happen while I go to this? What's going to happen while I go to this? Don't be scared. Just say, what's going to happen while I go? Why did you fall? Because I let go. And when I let go and it falls, why does it fall? Gravity. Okay, thank you. That's the one I was looking for. Gravity is not why. Gravity does not answer the question why. Gravity is a mathematical description of how things fall, not why things fall. Newton said things fall because God put gravity in place. Things fall because God ordered the world so that heavy things fall. And gravity is a mathematical description of how God ordered the world. Motion. That's at the end of his scientific book, the Principia Mathematica, in a section called the General Scholium, is where he talks about the concept of God and how God has ordered the world. Right? So every time you say it falls because of gravity.
Oh, so it falls because of how fast it falls.
Yeah. When you say it falls because of gravity, you're taking for granted Newton's laws. How many people in here can actually explain to me Newton's laws?
First three or whatever.
Well, no, that's just telling me what they are. Can you explain why they work? He took a book this big to explain. You understand how gravity actually works? You just take it for granted, don't you?
We take a lot of the summary for granted, and the shorter we can make things, the kind of grab definition, we like a jam-packed definition.
We don't want to have to rediscover gravity every day, the hard way especially, right?
Yeah.
Okay, this is yesterday when, what's your name again?
Jared,
when Jared asked about orthodoxy, and I said that the part of doxy at the end, doxa is opinion, and that word is related to dogma, And these words are related to the Latin word doctrine, which is a teaching or an opinion, a taught opinion, right? Everybody in here works off of having a lot of doctrines that you've taken for granted.
So when we look at something, anything, mm-hmm. and we just look at the commonplace for it that we've learned from society or wherever we learned it,
yeah.
and we don't think about all of the aspects, all the different...
You just don't bring it into question. You don't
yeah.
bring it into question. That's a quicker way to say it.
Is that
yeah.
taking it for granted? Like if you
yeah.
don't think, like okay,
sure.
saying the statement,
taking it for granted.
Anybody can be president, and you don't think about the
yeah.
stipulations that go with that. That's
right.
taking that for granted, right?
Right. When things are taken for granted, that's just another fancy way of it's not really fancy, but it's a common way of saying it. When things are taken for granted, that basically just means taken as given. Well, that's taken as given. Right? Religion just means faith in the impossible. That's for a lot of people, that's the definition of religion. Faith in the impossible. Right? Okay. Well, taken for granted. Yes, ma'am.
But there are certain things that we have to take for granted. Like, for
sure.
example, if somebody's breathing, we'll say he's living.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, but you can still ask about it. You can say, why do I take that for granted? Why is breathing?
Because if somebody asks me, are you living? So, you know, what's going to be the answer of that?
Depends on your definition of living.
We'll see. Yeah, now y'all are starting to philosophy. Right? There's a really wonderful, I'll actually put this up on Blackboard for those of you who want to like do extra reading. I know that everybody in here does. I'll put it up on there. This wonderful letter from Roman philosopher Seneca. And it's called De Brevitate Vitae, On the Shortness of Life. And in that letter, it's a letter that he wrote to a friend of his who's basically the third or fourth most powerful person in Rome. He was in charge of grain being brought into the city. And in a place like Rome that can't feed everybody off of the grain they grow around the city, that's a really important job, right? So he wrote this letter to his friend, and in this letter he says, you need to start living because you've basically only been existing. That a person can exist for 80 years, can reach the age of 80 years old and never live more than 3 or 4 years. Right? So for him, vitae, life, being vital, right, is different from taking a person's vitals, right? Which is the way we've truncated it down. Right? I just want to make sure that, what are your vitals? What's your respiration? What's your pulse? Right? Get your vitals and make sure that you're vital, right? That you're alive. But we take so many things for granted. So in philosophizing, which leads to new religious insights, leads to new art, leads to new science, philosophizing, we don't take anything for granted if we can help it. There are some things that you do take for granted, but then once you realize you're taking them for granted, you kind of like step back. Because right now, I'm taking for granted that everybody in this room speaks English enough to understand it. Right? But that calls into question not what is English, that calls into question, why do you understand me? What is language? Yeah.
What's the difference between taking something for granted and assuming?
Well, in taking something for granted, you take something as given, and assuming you make an ass out of you. Yeah, I'm an asshole. So,
I mean, I think assuming would be more of a pretense before taking for granted. So before you take something for granted, you just assume. That's like if I was to like walk through a doorway and I'm assuming that I'm going to clear this doorway and walk through it fine, but as soon as I get to the door, I'm taking for granted that if I hit something or something interrupts or somebody runs into me, like the doorway wasn't obviously not clear.
If you actually take something for granted, you actually aren't going to really think anything about it. But if you say, I assume, you've already started the question process.
Yeah.
But in saying, I assume, you're actually saying, I take up, right, to assume means to ascend or to take on. So when you say, I assume that I'll be able to get through the door, I assume that the chair worked. Or maybe when you say that, you're saying, I took for granted that the chair was okay, but now I see my assumption was wrong because, you know, I look back on it and I see that I had a bad assumption. So it's this questioning that's very important. Now, in some traditions, this kind of questioning leads to problems, and that's because there's something dogmatic about the structure of the tradition. But actually, the interesting aspect of the Axial Age philosophies that became the religions and the arts and the sciences that we all basically make use of is something very common to them is that they actually were reacting to the situation of their day and questioning, why are people suffering? Why are people starving? Why are people dying so young? Why is the sky blue? Why is this human body more desirable than that human body? And one of the things that all of them did, so all of the religions that we're going to be looking at, the overwhelming majority of the ones we're going to be looking at, start in the Axial Age, and they generally start, despite the fact that 2,000 years later they've all become fairly ritualized, they generally start with asking the question, why are we performing this ritual? Why do we not question this ritual? Why do we not question this habit? Why do we not question, you know, why does anyone not question Zeus? Why does anyone not question Indra? Right? And for some people that can be very dangerous. But the interesting aspect of the great religions that we're going to be, the great religions, the sacred traditions that we're going to be examining closer is, including the Abrahamic ones that we're only getting through in our discussions, is that they basically all start by asking questions. By figuring out what's been taken for granted. So, part of what you'll be doing when we get together for our one-on-one dialogue, which will be 30 to 45 minutes, is you're going to show up with your credo. Now, I don't mean by... Now, credo is a Latin word. It means I believe. Okay? So it's your creed. It's your belief. I believe. Not asking you to show up and tell me what your religious affiliation is if that's not something that you're comfortable talking about. I think for most of you, you'll be okay talking about those things, and it may be a part of what you believe, but here are the things that I want you to start asking about yourself and about life and about the world. I want you to ask yourself, what are the nameable aspects of the world that I believe in? What are the processes that I believe in such that if I did not believe these things, if I did not believe these processes, I would not be who I am? Well, I mean, you know, it's like when I say the nameable aspects of the world, I feel like I'm probably being too cute. I'm actually just trying to say all the stuff in the world that goes on, the processes, the things that, you know, make up your life, you know, maybe you grew up, like in Waxahachie, a lot of young men grew up believing in football or believing in baseball, right? Or basketball. and they believed in it. I don't mean that they were just really good football players. I mean they believed in it to the point of, you know, some of these people that I knew would not be who they were without football. That's the sort of thing, you know, they talk about, you know, people who peak in high school, right? Maybe they get caught a little bit too much in how they believe the structure of high school is, and they can't get out of it, and they don't ever transition into it. So your beliefs actually should be growing and changing as you get older, but the major issue here is that this is an opportunity for you to sit down with the Socratic philosopher and talk to me about what you believe, such that if you did not believe that, or you did not believe in that, you could not be who you are. Okay? Now, you're not, again, I want to really kind of to highlight this. Unlike, there are some ways that people talk about Socrates and they say, oh, Socrates was just there to, like, you know, confuse people and make them stop believing in the things that they believed in. I don't care to make you stop believing in the things that you believe in. I care to get you to express well what you believe in so that you're not threatened by other people's beliefs. Okay? So we'll have a discussion about that. Maybe what you believe, you know, and it's okay. One of the things that we'll be talking about before we get to the point where we actually have our dialogue is going to be how reality, the world you live in, basically is a set of beliefs. That's not to say that there's no matter. That's not to say that science is just a belief structure like every other belief structure, scientific, you know, right? I would not want electrical engineers to just, you know, believe that they're doing the electrical engineering correctly. Right? But that doesn't mean, in one sense, belief is a word that's been taken for granted too long. Belief is a word that has come basically to mean something that has no empirical evidence behind it, or little empirical evidence behind it, right? But in reality, believing is really what we do the majority of the time with our evidence and with the ways that we live. And you can have strong, well-informed beliefs, and you can have poor beliefs. But the issue with beliefs is, if they're being taken for granted and not questioned, and you've got a lot of really poor beliefs, you're screwing yourself up somehow.
No, belief is like directly tied to your consciousness, and I mean, by essence, then. So, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I guess, pretty much, yeah, it is your consciousness.
It's believing is what we do. And remember I said yesterday that believing is loving and living. Kiki, what did you...
Oh, I was just going to say, wouldn't that be faith? Because faith is the belief in something that has no proof or no physical... You know,
actually, faith is a form of belief. But it's a belief that's an ultimate concern in things that concern you ultimately. Faith is having an ultimate concern for things that concern you ultimately.
Do they concern you because they have no evidence?
It's not that. It's that faith is actually an act of trust. This is the reason why people will talk about it in terms of belief without any evidence. So basically, they've taken on the idea that faith is just trusting in something without any evidence, which then makes it sound like faith has no rational component to it. faith is often identified with a kind of leap, right? And that's because sometimes when you're talking about faith or taking a trust, you're leaping to something. But that doesn't mean that in leaping to something you don't look back and wonder about the leap. Or wonder how you leap, wonder how you got over, or any things like that. Faith is actually not as, and again, this is an aspect of the examinations that we're doing this summer session. Faith is not actually a way of thinking that refuses to think. It shouldn't be. Right? Faith may not need complete proof, but just because something doesn't need complete proof doesn't mean that you've decided to just be irrational and say that, you know, whatever crazy thing you want to say, right? Faith is a way of, so when I say it's ultimate concern for that which concerns you ultimately, I mean that there are limits to what you are as a human being. And you get up to those limits, and that a limit, an ultimate, a last, right? Something which there's no going beyond and knowing. And you just simply have to make a leap or a decision, right? Because it concerns you. How does Hamlet describe it? He says, to be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or take arms against the sea of troubles and die opposing in them. Die to sleep. Okay. Then he gets down to death. He's talking about that because he's actually asking, should I just kill myself or not? Right? That's what that whole soliloquy is about. And he gets down to death. And that's where you see death, of course, is your ultimate concern. Death is your ultimate concern. Ultimate concern. What concerns you at the last is your death. That undiscovered country from whose born no man returns suffers the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others we know not of. Death is your ultimate concern. Why is death your ultimate concern? Why is it your concern at last? Because it's the last thing you do. You are entities that are doers. Right? You do practices. You do thinkering, which is another kind of practice. But you do. You have abilities. You have this ability, these different abilities. But your last ability, not your last ability, not that you'll last a long time, but your last ability is to no longer be able to do. Every great philosophy recognizes this idea in the sense of faith. That it's an ultimate concern about what concerns you ultimately. How do I live such that I die well? Right? I get past the final exam. Or I get a better chance next time. Or whatever the case may be. So, and why is this the case? Because we're mortal. What does that mean that we're mortal? That we die. Mortal is actually just the French word for death. Mort. Right? You are mortal. You are mortal. You're mortal. You're going to die. I'm going to die probably sooner than most of y'all. Ohala. Right? That's what we do. We die. And we can either live well and die well, or we can just take everything for granted and die ignorant. So this is the stuff when you philosophize about religion and you philosophize about life and sacred tradition and loving and believing and examining yourself. It's so that you learn how to live so that you die well. And it very well may be the case. I'm not going to say that there's no life after death. I'm not going to say that something else doesn't happen. Because whether it's purely material, you turn into energy because you begin to degrade into energy. So you turn into worm food and plant food.